A space for conversation around women's health through the lens of naturopathic and Eastern medicine. I am Sandy Ross, and this is Her Earth Medicine Podcast. This podcast is multi-leveled. Episodes for patient education to graduate practitioner level. Thank you for tuning in, and I hope you gain value from this episode. Welcome back to the podcast, Amy Skilton.
Oh, thank you so much, Sandy. So nice to be talking to you again.
Thanks again for joining, and especially with such short notice, I really appreciate it. And the reason we're doing this podcast today is because we want to get information down to the people that have been flood affected. So we've got like a big, massive region of the Northern Rivers that has been really directly hit by these floods. And then now we've got the Sydney region. So there's a lot of people out there that are going to need this information. So first of all, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background as a building biologist and a little bit about how you got into working with mold illness?
Yeah, 100%. So I'm not actually yet fully qualified as a building biologist. I've got a way to go, but I am a qualified certified mold testing technician. Okay. And that was actually the first unit I did in my building biology studies. And prior to that, I didn't have any interest in mold, let me tell you, but I actually got really sick with mold exposure as a result of a water leak. And up until that point, and I still am as a functional medicine practitioner, so naturopath, nutritionist, medical herbalist, and, you know, I'd lived a very healthy life for 17 years until I ended up in a water damaged building. And in my case, it wasn't as a result of a flood. And so there's sort of a whole extra layer of complexity and danger with flood waters and that kind of volume of water. But it was 5 months of a bathroom leak that impacted the whole home that I was living in. And over that 5 month period, between when we moved in and when we realized what was happening, my health just deteriorated to the point where I was unrecognizable in every sense of the word, from fitness to weight to, you know, I went from having a razor sharp memory to inhalational Alzheimer's. Like, I couldn't figure out how to put clothes on, couldn't remember my own name. Like, everything that could go wrong, my body did go wrong. And so for me as a health professional, it was real. Two really big lessons came out of that. So the two really big lessons that I got out of that experience was, number one, as far as being a root cause medicine health professional, where, you know, we're trained to look for what's really going on in someone's life and dealing with that, there's a huge blind spot as far as how the built environment, which means, you know, the buildings that we inhabit, live in, play in, work in, you know, research and study and influence our health. And that's quite a broad subject, actually. It's much wider than mold and water damage, but it was like, wow, there was this whole area of health that I was completely oblivious of. And I like to think of myself as really abreast of, you know, the most current, you know, knowledge about things. The second thing that was a really rude shock to me was all of the tools in my toolkit that I had, which were plentiful, just were not a match for a toxic environment, an environment that was poisoning me. So even though I was taking incredible supplements, you know, vitamins, minerals, herbs, even medicines specific to what I was dealing with, the chronic exposure to the mycotoxins or the poisonous toxicants that mold produces, in fact, that's even a wider subject, which we'll get into, just there was just nothing you could take or do that was going to allow a human body to overcome that kind of level of poisoning. And so I studied initially as a mold testing technician, primarily so I could actually assess buildings for myself, so I would never end up in another water damaged building. And, you know, that did serve a really powerful purpose. But since then, obviously as a clinician, it has allowed me to actually see deeper and ask more specific questions about someone's environment, which more often than not highlights at least some of their health issues are coming from something in their home or their office. And so, yeah, it's very empowering when you come out the other side, but when you're in the middle of a crisis, like you've had a water leak, an ongoing water leak, or even acute water intrusion in the case of, you know, in this case, we're discussing the flooding, it can definitely feel very overwhelming when you're trying to navigate what to do next, what constitutes the, I guess, the best practice from a health point of view about recovering your possessions and your property, and also really knowing what health issues might develop out of that, how to prevent that, how to treat that, and how really to recognize that they're related to mold. Because I think one of the most difficult things for any human being on this planet is when you have symptoms that appear to be a mystery. Mm. I know, you know, at some stage, most of us will probably experience being told there's nothing wrong with us, or we can't find anything, and yet we feel sick as a dog, or, you know, just we just can't seem to get better. And I think one of the big pieces of that is the health of our environment. And, you know, I look forward to in the decades to come seeing that change and shift for people. But right now, there aren't a lot of people who are aware of this, which means many people, you know, even not flood affected, are currently being impacted in a negative way through mold and water damage exposure. But particularly for, you know, my fellow humans in the Northern Rivers, I'm here too in Kingscliff. Mm. I have to say, you know, I had PTSD triggered as a result, you know, from my own exposure, just knowing what lies ahead potentially for people if they're unaware of what they need to do to be able to, you know, correct their environment and look after their health. So I'm so, so grateful to have the opportunity to talk to you about that today.
Yeah. Oh, such a, so important to have someone like you that recognizes this and understands it so deeply to be able to come on and share this. So once again, thank you. Let's start on maybe, let's understand what is mold and why is it so potentially dangerous to people?
So just for some context, mold is everywhere. There's like not a place on the planet that mold doesn't thrive. It's even growing in Chernobyl in radioactive conditions. There's a species that grows on jet fuel. So when we talk about mold and its impact on health, we're really divvying up that kingdom, if you like, into the molds that are pathogenic or toxigen, i.e. that they produce poisons. And what we see is there's a huge difference between mold that acts as a natural degrading and recycling agent out in nature versus the kinds of molds that will spring up and thrive and proliferate in a water-damaged building. So how mold can make people sick, there's a multitude of ways. Certainly just the airborne irritants, the particulate matter, can have very much the same effect on people like pollens do to people who are sensitive to, you know, springtime, get springtime rhinitis. So sneezing, itchy eyes, watery eyes, itchy throat, and also triggering asthma. So that's sort of some of those initial things that you'll get. There are certain species that are more notorious for triggering that than others, and they tend to be the ones that that really proliferate with high humidity, which the Northern Rivers also experiences. So this might be something that residents here have had ongoingly anyway, because none of us are actually taught how to manage the environment and the microbiome of our home to prevent even those molds from growing. But in addition to that, we can, in some people, develop fungal infections, especially if they're immunocompromised. We can see fungal infections in the sinuses and the lungs. But more typically, if someone's living in a moldy building, we'll see things like tinea, so athlete's foot, little fungal infections between the toes, maybe jock itch, maybe like itchy rashes under the armpits, or just general rashes that are persistent and won't go away. And some of those are more inflammatory and allergic type rashes rather than an infection, but certainly infections, fungal skin infections that are really resistant to treatment are another red flag someone's being exposed to mold. That being said, before I go on to the toxicants that mold produces, I also just want to point out mold is actually a proxy for moisture and other microbes. So whenever water is introduced into a building where it shouldn't be, so in the soft furnishings or in the porous materials that the interior cladding is usually made out of, that will foster microbial growth of all descriptions. Mm. And probably just to keep it simple, we'll just stick with mold and bacteria, but just know there's a whole circus of creepy crawly things that will just come to life when water is available and food is available, which is the building materials. And what happens is a little bit like where you might have competing groups for resources, is there can be a bit of a battle between the microbes occurring. And so mold will produce mycotoxins to actually try and kill off the bacteria so it gets more of the water and the moisture source. Bacteria will also produce endotoxins and other toxins, which are also incredibly inflammatory. So what we find in a water damaged building is chronic infections of all kinds of manner of description, but typically respiratory tract type symptoms. So just feeling like you've always got a cold, feeling like you've always got a sore throat, feeling like you're always clearing your throat of mucus, like you've got something in your chest. Pneumonia is a big one, just repeated bouts of pneumonia as well. And it's because you've got all of this bacterial and fungal species that are just proliferating and you're inhaling it, you've got it on your skin, you're ingesting it to a degree, which is also why we see gut problems occurring as well with mold and moisture damage exposure. So I guess we're going to probably repeat the word mold a multitude of times, but whenever you hear the word mold, I want you to remember that it actually means microbes. It's a proxy for water damaged microbes, and what you're actually being exposed to are things you can't see as well, like bacteria. And so there's a few things there that obviously aren't great for our health. But in addition to that, the toxins that these microbes produce, and in particular mycotoxins, are very, very poisonous for the body. So when we think about poisons, I think most people would think of things like arsenic or cyanide, or, you know, things like that would spring to mind. But these, like, and also man-made toxins, so synthetic chemical-based poisons. However, nature-made or mold-made poisons are incredibly toxic. In fact, I saw one study that was saying that mycotoxins were 800 times more poisonous than pesticides. Now, obviously, it depends on, you know, the mycotoxin, the person's ability to detoxify, the volume that they were exposed to, and also the length of exposure. But I suppose I'm sharing that because I just want people to take seriously how damaging these toxins can be. And they damage, some toxins have an affinity for certain organs. So certain toxins will significantly damage the gut, and over a period of time, increase the risk of gastrointestinal cancers. Others will damage the liver. Others will damage the kidneys. Others will damage the brain. And so the poisonous, and whether or not you have what we call a mold susceptible haplotype or mold susceptible genetics or not, they're poisonous to everybody. Mm. But what we find is there is a portion of the population, somewhere between 24 and 33%, depending on which parameters you're sort of looking at this stage that we know of, actually have an immune system that is not capable of eliminating those biotoxins very well. And as a result, the innate immune system gets triggered and we see just chronic inflammation and all kinds of, it's a domino effect there with the breakdown in the tissues and the organs and the overall system. So that can lead to all kinds of conditions, including inhalational Alzheimer's, like I got, things like fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome, weight issues. So it really depends, again, on what you're exposed to, what is the volume of that. You know, if you had a small, if the flood only affected your, you know, your garage downstairs, the impact is going to be a lot less than if it actually flooded, you know, roof high and your entire house got soaked in water. It also, the impact on you is going to depend on whether or not you've only been exposed for a few days, maybe while you're cleaning up, which isn't good, obviously, but as opposed to, say, moving back into a water-damaged home and living in it without actually remediating it properly. So this isn't sort of a guaranteed outcome for everyone exposed to mold, but mold is poisonous to everyone, and for a variety of reasons, you are almost certainly going to experience some symptoms. One of the other things I should have mentioned was when mold is growing, or more specifically, when it is eating, it's got a water source and a food supply. As a product of its digestion, a bit like the way people fart or emit gas, mold will do the same, and its gases are VOCs, or volatile organic compounds.
Okay.
And they can also be toxic in their own right and make people feel very dizzy, headachy, nauseous. Again, it's like another form of poisoning. I guess a good example I can give you is if you've ever walked into a home that's just been freshly painted, and let's say they didn't use low VOC paint, those paint fumes just hit you like a slap in the face. The new car smell is that, I guess, to a lesser degree, and some people are more sensitive to those things than others, but you're actually inhaling toxicants that over a period of time will make you feel really unwell. And so the VOCs that the mold are producing will do that. And of course, the endotoxins from bacteria can make you very, very sick and very, very inflamed quickly. So it's why it's very complex. It's also why it's quite challenging to treat. It's why it can be really tricky to diagnose definitively, because there's so many pathways that are triggered. There's so many elements to what happens when there's water damage or flooding and the things that spring up, that it's not a finite science, which can make it very frustrating for people with chronic exposure, because it's very difficult to pinpoint. And I suppose the only blessing, I don't even want to call it that because that's just not the right word, but if you've been exposed to mold at this level with flooding on such a high volume and such close proximity, the symptoms you develop as a result of that are going to be obviously attributed to mold. You're not going to be left guessing. Was it this exposure to, you know, all of my wet possessions and the wet drywall and all of that sort of stuff? You're going to know that for sure, which thankfully makes the path out a lot clearer and a lot quicker in some regards in terms of treatment and diagnosis.
Okay. So some of those acute symptoms that people are going to be noticing probably like around now while they're cleaning the mold, headaches, sinusitis, potential cough, respiratory issues, like allergenic sort of sensations. Yeah. And then more long-term, which we're talking about like a few months exposure, I guess potentially a lot of these guys have been flooded before and they might have been already exposed to some degree of mold. So more those like CIRS symptoms, so like chronic fatigue and like chronic respiratory stuff, inflammation in the body. Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, those things can, you know, for some people might come on a little quicker, like within a week or two.
Okay.
It's certainly going to be exacerbated and muddied a bit with all the stress, which we'll talk about in a minute too, because obviously stress and the lack of sleep, I know from speaking to people at the evacuation centre, you know, the trauma and also just the overwhelm of trying to navigate everything, literally everything. They're not sleeping, they're not coping. If they did have things that they would have normally drawn upon to recalibrate, like yoga, they don't have a yoga mat, they don't have anywhere private or quiet to do yoga, all of those kinds of things. So that's obviously adding a layer to this that wouldn't otherwise necessarily be present. But, you know, it could come on quite quickly within a few days or a few weeks, or it may be months down the line. And as you said, because this area, there are areas that are prone to flooding and have definitely been underwater before, and the relative humidity here is high for at least a good half of the year. It's really only a couple of months in the last year that I've lived here, I think it was in winter, where the humidity was low enough not to need to turn the dehumidifier on or the aircon on.
Wow.
So what that means is even if your home has never been flooded, and maybe if you're one of the lucky ones who didn't get flooded this time either, but you just happen to be listening to this, you might even recognize some of these symptoms as a result of just the mold in the home from the humidity. And that what I see and hear a lot of from locals are joint pain, chronic pain, especially fibromyalgia if it gets diagnosed formally, chronic fatigue, and I see a lot of gut problems, especially SIBO, because mycotoxins are designed to kill bacteria, making them antibiotics. Okay. So very much like when we take oral antibiotics, which destroys the microbiome, you've got a slower, more chronic but persistent exposure to something that's going to impact your microbiome internally. And also weight, especially. So if you've got gut problems as a result of mold, typically we might see someone who's underweight, who finds it very difficult to gain weight, and they might have lots of food intolerances as well. But because of the chronic inflammation that can get triggered, if the gut is okay, we can see leptin being triggered and just actually quite rapid weight gain. And the weight is just very resistant to moving. It's almost like you just can't do anything diet, exercise-wise to shift it. Often it'll just keep a lid on it, or it will still keep creeping up slowly. And certainly that was how I was impacted as a result of my exposure to water damage. I put on, I think, 15 kilos in like not even three months. I feel like it was just a couple of months. It was just extraordinary. And as someone who'd always had, like, not effortlessly, I wasn't one of those people who could just eat anything and not put on weight, but, like, you know, I didn't flog myself in the gym or watch what I ate. I just ate well and moved regularly, like super basic stuff. And my weight had stayed within a range of like a 4 kilo window for like my whole adult life. So for it to just blow out like that as a nutritionist, like, and someone who, you know, who knows weight loss, was just so bizarre to me. So, I do wonder if some of those persistent weight issues that we do see in this area are actually a result of mold and nothing more.
Do you notice the weight impact anywhere particular in the body? Is it like a puffy sort of weight? Is it all over distributed? Is there a particular type of weight gain you see?
So it can vary. For me, it was just all over. Mm-hmm. I just gained fat everywhere. Yeah. But in addition to that, inflammation will cause fluid retention. Mm. And so my face, my bone structure, my facial structure in particular was quite different. And above my eyes, like that eyelid-y area was very, very puffy for me anyway. Mm. That was just probably the place it showed up. One of the things that happens with chronic inflammation is we see all kinds of enzymes get upregulated. One of them is called aromatase, which converts testosterone into estrogen. And what that can create in both sexes, biological sexes, is a condition of excess estrogen, regardless of what else is happening, but also lower androgens. So in particular for men, we would see gynecomastia, or what is commonly referred to as man boobs, because it's more of an estrogen weight deposit, and also on the thighs. So typically androgenic weight gain would be around the midsection. And certainly for women, we might see, we might even see breast size go up as well, particularly if they're being exposed to fusarium species, because the mycotoxins that they produce are really, like, I can't even like stress how strongly potent xenoestrogens they are. Zearalenone in particular has been used in commercial agriculture to, you know, accelerate sexual development in animals, and it's actually banned in a lot of countries because it's really bad for you. But certainly that can cause fertility issues, menstrual issues in women as well. But it depends on the individual, but it does increase estrogen typical fat deposition. So thighs, hips, and breasts.
Okay. So everyone eat your broccoli sprouts at the moment.
Yes. All the cruciferous veg.
Yeah, I think a lot of them didn't have any fresh, and a lot of them still don't, any fresh produce available for weeks. So sprouts are a good idea because you can put them in a jar. I like them. So maybe we'll get some of them down there. Now, you started to touch a little bit about stress and the impact it has on the immune system. Can we go down there? Because I think this is where everyone is right now, is fight and flight.
Yes. So there's a couple of elements here to consider. Certainly when it comes to mold, an immune system that's functioning well, assuming you don't have a genetic vulnerability, is going to be really important in order for you to metabolize those toxins in a timely manner and to limit the impact on your body and to limit the amount of inflammation that gets triggered. But in addition to that, stress we know suppresses the immune system. And the biological reason for that is your cells, whenever it receives the stress signal of adrenaline, doesn't know the difference between your house is on fire, you're being chased by an axe murderer, you've got exams, your house just got flooded, you're being chased by a bear, you know, any of those things which put you, like, can be a psychological stress or a physiological stress. It's all the same message to your cells. And as a result, because the immune system actually requires a lot of energy to function, the body will jack up all kinds of survival hormones, so things like adrenaline and cortisol, for instance, in order to help you escape the initial danger. Because, you know, eons ago, pre-industrial revolution, our stresses tended to be self-limiting, you know, usually lethal. We either survived or we didn't, and it was done. Whereas we live in an age now where stress is very chronic. And in the case of this flooding, it's not fixed overnight and things aren't going to go back to normal in a week. And so, unfortunately, what's happening with that elevated level of cortisol is we're seeing immune function being depressed, which opens people up to infections, or they're more at risk of catching something that might be going around. And obviously we've got issues with the floodwaters, contaminants in the floodwaters, the sewage, the fact that the water has been standing for days, so it's now category 3 or black water, meaning it's just really toxic and riddled with pathogens. Fortunately, you know, it's late summer here, so everyone's vitamin D is going to be as high as it's going to get, considering we've had La Nina this year. So respiratory tract viruses, not so much of a threat than if this had happened in winter or spring. But, you know, we're still currently in, you know, chapter 3 of COVID. So we've got to consider that for those who are already immunocompromised or have risk factors. Now this is like another layer on top of that. So how we support that, I mean, certainly herbal medicine and nutritional medicine is wonderful to help bolster the immune system, and I would absolutely be relying on those things. But also, and this I know is going to be a bit of a stretch for a lot of people, but finding ways to recalibrate your nervous system when and where you can. It can be hard even understanding how you could even do that. And I'll give you a couple of really like quick tricks in a minute. But when someone's in a state of shock or trauma, even just pulling yourself out of that for self-care, given the opportunity, can be quite difficult. So, you know, where you can initially unload with a friend, or if you've got access to counselling, that's probably the first step, getting some support. But certainly bringing yourself into parasympathetic nervous system mode is going to be a priority. And I know it probably feels a bit pointless and silly as well, like if you've lost your house, everything that you owned, maybe also the place, you know, how you made an income. I know there were a lot of people who ran businesses from home here, or maybe you've lost your car and you now can't get to your job. I do understand that this probably sounds like the last thing you need to be doing. But if you consider that we are in a bit of a marathon here, it isn't going to serve you to stay in fight or flight until it's finished, because that is actually only going to help you in the first couple of days, maybe in the week. And then after that, it's going to destroy you. It's going to erode your immunity. It's going to erode your adrenal function, appropriate function. You're going to be impacted sleep-wise. And I promise you, just even taking 5 minutes once a day, ideally 10 minutes twice a day or more if you can get it, just to really bring your nervous system back into a more down-regulated state, will be one of the best things you can do for your nervous system, your adrenals, your whole body, but also your immune system, which really needs you to be its best friend right now, given that you're being exposed to all sorts of things. So I'd love to hear some of your suggestions too, Sandy, but the two couple that are just springing to mind initially, because I'm mindful also that people are probably conserving what resources they have to rebuild and replace things. So there's lots of things you can do for free that will actually make a big difference. So probably the first one I would say is activating your vagus nerve. And there are a number of ways you can do that. In fact, I might even share an article if you don't have one handy, Sandy, but there's a few ways you can do it. Even things like ice baths, which are probably not going to be, you know, workable right now, humming, singing, gargling, there's actually an access point in the ear on both sides. And as acupuncturist, this area, if you pinch it, it's actually the one of the terminating branches of the vagus nerve.
Yes.
And so if you pinch it quite firmly and rub your fingers together, you can actually stimulate the vagus nerve. Now, for anyone who's like, what is the vagus nerve? Because they've just gone from like 0 to 100. The vagus nerve is just a huge bundle of nerves that run up through the whole center of our torso and up into our head. And basically it's like the switch that can pull us back into parasympathetic state, which is a calm, relaxed, centered and grounded state, as opposed to feeling triggered and sped up and anxious and stressed. And I've utilized it to pull myself out of panic attacks, which is primarily how I've used it personally, but you can actually use it at any time just to bring yourself down a notch or two. If you're feeling stressed, overwhelmed, under pressure, you want to cry, with frustration and grief and all of those things. And it's not about bypassing those feelings either, because those obviously need to be felt and released and, you know, expressed. But in the moment when you're in the middle of doing what needs to be done and you feel like you just can't go on or you're about to have a meltdown, it is a tool that can just help you lift yourself for that period of time. But you can also use it at night to help you get better sleep. I'd recommend doing it before meals to help switch your digestion on, because when we're stressed, we, you know, our blood is funneled somewhere else, and so our gut can suffer. And anytime you just feel like you need to recalibrate, grounding, if you have clean and available earth to go and stand on, sit on and lie on. It's not going to be possible for everybody, but if you have access to the beach or any sort of green areas, parks or fields that haven't been affected by floodwaters, at the beginning of the day or at the end of the day, getting your bare feet on the earth can be a really nice way to recalibrate your electrophysiology. And not to get really technical or nerdy, but basically, you know, very much like all of our machines and devices that we use, we actually have our own electrical circuits, which of course acupuncturists know better than anybody. And when we are stressed or unwell, or our antioxidant status is low, or our nutrition isn't great, which of course at the moment with people primarily surviving on canned food or packaged food is definitely, you know, not ideal, we accumulate positive charge. And it's the negative ions that are healthful and positive charges actually that can really interrupt cellular function and affect our health. Now, just like our houses are grounded to the earth so that excess electrons and electric, you know, can recalibrate the electric field, we have to do the same. And so barefoot in the sand or wet earth, dirt, it even works on concrete, although I don't love recommending that, but you can also do concrete, allows you to discharge those positive charges into the earth and also take up the negative ions that sit on the, like 3 feet above the ground on the earth. So lying down is even better if you can manage it. And probably the last thing I'll say is just even giving yourself, not just sitting down for meals, because I think it would be tempting to eat on the run and keep going, but the sunlight has such a profound effect on our circadian rhythm and our ability to sleep properly that, you know, obviously if you're exhausted and need to sleep, and then by all means do that. I would never say compromise on sleep, but if you are someone who's awake around sunrise or just before, just take a couple of minutes outside to actually witness the sunrise to come up. In some ways, philosophically speaking, I think it's a nice reminder that, you know, you've got another fresh day and life is just going to keep getting better from here. But watching the sunrise and also the sunset allows your whole nervous system to orient itself with the daylight. And I think, you know, that can get discombobulated with stress hormones. So those are just, you know, three free things that you can do, which sound almost like they wouldn't do anything, but I can tell you right now that they're all very powerful in and of their own right, and absolutely, might just be that, you know, that supportive edge that you need to take yourself from where you are right now to coming out the other side and feeling like you haven't just been wrecked by the whole experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And you did touch on gargling and humming, and I think that needs to be highlighted, that that's something people can do twice a day, or they can hum when they're driving or singing as well. There is a few acupuncture hubs now set up over around the Northern Rivers, so people can reach out. There's the roaming clinics happening now, so, you know, if people don't have the funds, they can try and reach out and see if they can get some nervous system support. But those free tools like grounding, there's that great app Insight Timer, so, you know, you can put in the 5 minutes if that's all you feel like you've got to do. You can do 2 minutes, it's still going to make an impact on your nervous system. So there's definitely those free things, like you said, that are, like you said, they sound like they're not going to do much, but they absolutely do. And then go to your other things, you know, the acupuncture. We do things like the nada as well, with the auricular acupuncture. The ear and acupuncture, there's a lot that happens within that, and so it's amazing now that they've connected the vagus nerve stimulation with the auricular. And I think there'll be a lot more to come, devices that will be available and whatnot. So yeah, definitely try out some of those free tips, because our nervous system right now needs support for everyone around that area. Absolutely. What are some of the things, if people start experiencing symptoms? I mean, they can obviously go, yeah, it's probably mold. I've been so exposed, I'm living in a moldy house. But what are some of the potential medical tests that they could check out to see if they do have mold exposure? Or if, you know, because some people might be thinking it's long-term stress, it could be some other, you know, COVID's around as well. What kind of testing can you advise for people to run to just check out to see if they have mold exposure?
So testing is a tricky area because there's, like with a lot of things, tests certainly in isolation aren't particularly helpful. So for example, I never do urinary mycotoxins because we're exposed all the time, and who knows, they could have come from food, could have come from somewhere you visited, and it's not a chronic thing. The other thing is, if someone's genetically susceptible and they can't tag biotoxins for excretion, they're actually, their tests are probably going to look quite good.
They're not detoxing them.
And it doesn't change how you would treat, and it doesn't change what you would do to remediate the environment. I mean, I wouldn't say I'd never use it, but it's probably on the bottom of the list of the tests that I would call upon. The other thing to be mindful of, and I will talk about some of the tests you can order, but none of the other tests are covered on Medicare. And to run the full suite of tests, it's $2,000. And if you know you've been exposed to mold and your symptoms arose, you know, in proximity to that, I just wouldn't even waste any money on testing those things. And this is, you know, I spent that money on all those tests at the time, and that was partly because, you know, SIRS was a new thing for me. We had to move really quickly with everything for legal reasons, and, you know, I did all of them for legal reasons. But I don't often recommend the whole suite to clients that I suspect have SIRS. I usually will only do a few to confirm that's what's happening, and I will pick them based on the symptoms they have. So, for example, transforming growth factor beta 1, or TGF beta 1, is known to cause nervous system inflammation. So it can cause tremors, and it can also cause like neuroseizures. So people might feel, I personally could feel my nerves felt like they were on fire. I could just about draw my nervous system. I could feel every single nerve in my body on fire. It was horrific. But other people might get crawling sensations, prickling sensations. They might feel cold sensations. So if there is a neuresthesia of some sort or neuralgia of any sort, I might just pick that one. Mm-hmm. If they are experiencing poor circulation issues, so Raynaud's, numbness, cramping, if they get pins and needles really easily, their hands go numb. If, you know, for me personally, I always sleep with my hand under my face and my hand was going completely numb. So typically what we see there is low vascular endothelial growth factor or low VEGF and high C4A or complement 4A. C4A is probably one that I would almost always run because that is a marker that is quite, it's not specific just to mold, but is quite, is specific to mold at the same time. The issue with this area is also Lyme-like illness is quite common. So insect bites, everyone thinks of a tick bite, and certainly ticks can spread bacteria that can create this kind of illness, you know, even mosquitoes and things like that. And so C3A will allow you to see whether that's also online. And so in this area, I'd probably consider do both of those. The other one you could consider is alpha MSH, and that's melanocyte stimulating hormone or a fraction of it. And that's low in 95% of SIRS patients and in chronic mold exposure as well. And of course, being a the peptide that it is, impacts all kinds of other neurotransmitters in the brain. So my view is to do enough tests to determine for sure the direction you're going in. I'll often run the genetic vulnerability test though, because that determines the direction of treatment. If you don't have a mold susceptible gene, you'll recover a lot quicker with a lot less supplements. Mm. But if you do have a mold susceptible gene, you're going to need a lot of step-by-step support. And you're also going to have to be a lot stricter about the environment that you're in. So it is a little bit tricky and quite individual, but I hope that gives you a bit of an idea of what I would suggest.
Yes, I mean, that might sound very complex for people listening in that are like, what did she say? Who do I do these with? So, I mean, you could get a functional medicine doctor or, you know, a GP open to testing some of these. Otherwise, you might need to work with a functional medicine naturopath. There is also, I will upload it in the show notes, the SIRS questionnaire as well. I guess that could be quite handy.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, and the VCS test. Let's put the link for that in there too. So okay. Just going back to the blood test for 1 second, and then I'll come back to the questionnaire and the VCS. But you can order some of those bloods yourself if you wanted to. You're going to pay out of pocket anyway. There's a couple of labs that you can get them done through, and I'll email those across. That being said, to get help from there, you're going to need to engage someone who is mold/SIRS literate. And I think in the first instance, I would go to the Toxic Mold Support website. We'll include the link in the show notes. I've actually got a list of GPs that have been trained specifically, as well as naturopaths and other clinicians who've been trained specifically, because it's actually a very complex thing to deal with. And what I do find is, unless someone's had specific training, this isn't always the case, of course. A lot of brackies are very committed to up-leveling their own education, you know, just on their own. But what I have found is a lot of clinicians don't understand how to approach it, what it really is. Some assume it's an allergy, some treat it like an infection and give antifungals, when it's that and so much more. It's poisoning, it's immune inflammation, which then dysregulates all this other stuff in the body. And there is actually a 12-step process to go through, and you've got to follow it in order to get well. And I know it might feel a bit daunting, and it's also not a cheap exercise to work with a clinician. However, what I also see happening time and time again is people just really unwell, spending a lot of money on stuff and getting zero results, and then years later going, finally seeing someone. And I don't want that for you either. So connect in with someone. There's also a lot of really amazing free resources on the Toxic Mold Support Australia website and Facebook group. You can also ask for personal recommendations for clinicians in there based on what you would prefer and what you're looking for. So, yeah, certainly there's a lot of help there, but I think shortcutting things to save your time and money and health, as long as it's, you know, as long as you're not missing anything obvious, there's a balancing act there, because I've seen people waste an awful lot of money and time not getting anywhere as well. But, yes, two free things you can do are the VCS test, which is a visual contrast sensitivity test. Now, this is not specifically diagnostic, but it's an online test which tests visual contrast. This is different to visual acuity, which is what an optometrist will look at. And it's basically looking for your ability to distinguish contrast between colors and shades. And what it's really highlighting is neuroinflammation. And so the reason it's not specific to mold is neuroinflammation can be triggered from alcohol, other chemicals, trauma, things like that. But if you fail it, and there's particular columns that are more specific to biotoxin exposure, it'll give you a report and say, oh, this actually looks like you're being impacted by biotoxins. Take the next steps. The SIRS questionnaire, or even just looking at the symptoms, can also really help you go, you know, if I'm ticking six of those, if you're under 18, you almost certainly got biotoxin illness. If you're over 18, if you're ticking eight or more, you've almost certainly got biotoxin illness. The test you would run was really just to confirm that. That's the direction to go in, and of course eliminate any other possibilities. And that's where, you know, seeing your regular GP can be helpful, because they'll run those standard blood tests and make sure there's nothing else going on that, you know, could be influencing your symptoms or generating those symptoms. So yeah, certainly those two things are free initially, and then you could look at doing pathology testing after that if you felt that was necessary.
Hi guys, because mold is such a big topic and there is so much information in this podcast, I decided to split it into two parts. So in part two, we are going into supplements that you can support your body with for acute exposure, what to clean mold with and how to clean it, what is worth saving and what you need to really consider that you need to get rid of. And also we touch on water and what you can do to protect yourself from getting acute infections from the water at the moment. So check that out in part two with Amy Skilton. Thank you for listening. I have been a practitioner of naturopathic and Chinese medicine for over a decade. I have a master's degree of health science and I am an academic lecturer at Australia's leading natural medicine college. I am available worldwide online for bookings. Simply go to sandyrosshealth.com.